This is a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat
with guest Mary Cutrafello.
I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com. So, this is another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, and joining me today is Mary Cutrafello from the great state of Minnesota.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm good, Diesel, man. It's good to be back in Cleveland.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you're here. We get to see you about once a year.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got to see you a little bit extra this year because you came down to the Wigwam Music Festival in Kentucky with us.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. It's three days. It's a really cool old motor court with all the rooms shaped like wigwams. And it kind of gets, you know, I have a degree in American Studies, and so I studied a lot of, you know, roadside ephemera, and that's as classic a piece of it is still around. And it was a thrill to stay in the wigwam for 3 days, but also just it was a great music festival too.
Indeed. Very, very cool thing. Second year that it's been put on by Jay Johnson, who runs the Honky Tonk House Concert Series. So I definitely will be back next year. I hope you will be too.
If it's at all possible and they'd like to have me, I would love to be back.
Nice, nice. But like you say, you are currently in Cleveland, and we are at the Fairview Tavern where you'll be playing your show tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I guess before we discuss the new album that you're going to have, I want to get into your background a little bit for people that don't know.
Sure.
First of all, you were raised in Connecticut.
Yes, born and raised.
Now, when Jay Johnson, aforementioned, introduced you at the Wigwam Festival, he did mention that you have been called the next Bruce Springsteen.
That was a long time ago, but yes.
It may have been, but I think that you know, speaks to your roots because, you know, he's a Jersey boy, you're from Connecticut, one side or the other, New York, basically.
Yeah, that's certainly true, and you know, that was growing up in that part of the country, you really do get a, you know, a full dose of Springsteen, especially in the, you know, the 70s and 80s, and, you know, so I guess it's gonna be a part of what I do, doing mainstream, you know, the mainstream rock part of what I do, just because of where I'm from. But also, Springsteen really spoke to me as a writer, and as a live performer. And I think those are, you know, two parts of my game that I've certainly tried to, you know, at least live up to what he put down.
Very good. So, besides Springsteen, what kind of music did you interact with when you were younger?
Well, my parents were big Broadway fans.
Okay.
I mean, they weren't theater people, they were theater goers. So there were dozens of Broadway cast albums in the house. And that was kind of the first music that I listened to. You know, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Stephen Sondheim, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as I got a little bit older, I'd turn on the radio and I found WNEW is the big rock station out of New York, and that was, you know, my constant companion through my teenage years. So it's a little bit of exactly what you'd expect, and a little bit of maybe not what you'd expect.
Gotcha. Well, I guess on the side of not what you would expect, because you do definitely in your music today have that Heartland rock component that you can see very strongly.
Right.
But there's also a strong Texas influence.
Yes.
And you lived there for a number of years. Can you tell us what drew you to that kind of music?
Well, no, is the short answer. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of it in New England. And, you know, it was the bumper music on the Dukes of Hazzard. It was, you know, putting on Hee Haw to annoy my parents. I mean, it was like little things like that. And I guess maybe some of the crossover stuff in the late 70s where, you know, the Kenny Rogers and stuff kind of crept onto mainstream radio. And I don't know, it was just all, there wasn't a whole lot to go on. But when I got to college, I had a band and I was, you know, just doing a rock thing, and I just kind of was looking for new sounds and new songs and just a different point of view, and I found some Dwight Yoakam, Steve Earle, and Marty Stewart records at the local campus record store, and those were kind of the three artists that got me down that path, and then I just started exploring from there, looking at who wrote the songs, and then, you know, trying to find out about them or other artists that were covering songs or doing songs by those writers, and mm-hmm. It was more of almost an intellectual curiosity, like a research project mm-hmm. at first, you know, and then I really found something I could sink my teeth into.
Very cool. I find that interesting personally because, you know, I was very much the same way. I didn't have any exposure to country until after college, in my case, really. I mean, I've been into folk music and stuff in college and all that, so sure. I had, you know, the Carter Family and mm-hmm. Woody Guthrie and early country stuff, but yeah, it took me a while to latch onto it, too. But liking the music and moving to Texas to play music are pretty far apart. So how did you make that leap?
Well, I had to do something. You know, I grew up...
Oh, yeah, you graduated from Yale, and it's like,
I
got to do something now, right?
I was at a crossroads.
I could get a job, but...
Yeah, yeah. Everybody was doing that.
Yeah. That was pretty much my philosophy, too.
No, I mean, I grew up in Connecticut. Yale is in Connecticut, and mm-hmm. I really wanted to go and see more of this country that I just spent 4 years earning a degree, which kind of says I know something about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had a lot of book learning, but I really wanted to get out there.
Had you traveled at all, really, up until then?
I took a big trip around the country with my parents, with my, you know, the whole family.
Gotcha.
The summer before my freshman year in college.
Okay.
And that kind of whet my appetite, but I didn't have the wherewithal to do anything about it other than earn the degree, I guess.
Gotcha.
But then it was like, man, I bought a truck. I was like, man, I'm gonna go to a completely new area of the country for me, someplace I've never been. I've got something I want to learn. I know where to go to learn it, and this is gonna be like my grad school. Yeah. And that was kind of the way I approached it. I wanted to learn what I could learn and learn enough to make a living with what I was learning. That was my goal.
Mm-hmm. So you ended up in Houston first, is that correct?
Or no, Austin first.
Austin first,
for about
okay.
a year and a half.
Okay. And what made you stop there?
Because it's Austin.
There you go. I know it was a pretty obvious question, but
there wasn't anything specific. I'd never been to anywhere in Texas before. Uh-huh. I mean, it was like Austin City Limits. I mean, it just, you know, everything seemed to be emanating from there, and I figured it was as good a place as any to start.
Gotcha. And then why did you decide to change bases to Houston later on, then?
Well, because Austin, as much fun as it was and is, it just wasn't enough of a big city for me. You know, I grew up 55 miles from Times Square,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I needed a little bit more hustle bustle. And you know, even though Austin was growing by the day, it had, you know, kind of a small town feel, which I know some people think is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
but for me it just felt like an overgrown small town, whereas Houston felt like an actual city.
Okay. And how would you compare the two music scenes at the time? I mean, were there different influences that you got because you moved to Houston, or?
The honky-tonk scene, the country scene, was a lot smaller,
mm-hmm.
but the cats there could play. You know, they could really play. There was a cool blues scene there that I didn't dive into too much because blues wasn't kind of why I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But a real kind of idiosyncratic blues scene, a bunch of cool players like Carolyn Wonderland came out of that scene, but also guys like Terry Green that I don't know if they ever really got well known outside of Houston itself. And it's like people were just proud to be from Houston. They didn't really care what happened in other places or if they went other places, because the scene was nurturing enough, as you know, as it was. And there's other things going on in Houston. There's a rap scene about which I know less than nothing, and you know, and Tejano, and I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot going on. But the country scene, I mean, I lived there because I liked the vibe of the city.
Gotcha.
And I knew all the players, and by the time I moved there, I was playing all over the state, so I spent a lot of time in a lot of places, and I could have really been just about anywhere.
Gotcha. So you're unique in respect to a lot of the people that we talk to on this show, but not necessarily so unique in respect to Americana at the time that you came up, in that your first two albums were at a major label, correct?
The first, well...
The second one.
I did one myself.
Right.
You know, the obligatory one that gets you onto the major label. And I did one for the label.
Okay, okay. But then, you know, the last number of years, however many it's been, you've been mostly doing everything on your own.
Yeah, I've been independent ever since the one for Mercury. Yeah.
Gotcha. So, first of all, I guess can you tell us just a little bit about what it was like in the early years? I mean, you ended up playing Austin City Limits twice.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Yes.
You've gotten a lot of opportunities that a lot of other musicians never get.
That's true.
So can you tell us what that was like?
Well, it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was... I don't know if I would say it was a dream come true, because it was just kind of... It was me doing what I do, and you know, I always kind of operated under the assumption that if you do what you do and you do it well, good things will come to you, and that was sort of, you know... what happened, but it was a whole lot of fun, and I get to learn so many things about how the music business works. Most of them good, some of them somewhat unsavory, but you know, it was an education that stood me in good stead going down the road. Just knowing how to do stuff, or just knowing that there's the puzzle fits together in a few different ways. You know, it's not always what it looks like when you're playing a club like the Fairview Tavern.
Gotcha. But then, which label were you on again?
Mercury,
that's what I thought. Yeah. They ended up merging, as happened to so many other companies at the time.
Yep.
And it's happened to a lot of people who sort of play in the genre that you do.
True.
They ended up without a label, essentially, and sort of kicked to the streets. How did you feel when that happened, and how did you make the transition?
Well, first of all, the folks at Mercury, which morphed into Island Def Jam, and became like an urban label, so...
You would fit in perfectly, is what right. You're saying.
Yeah. They brought in all new people. They didn't know what to do with me. I didn't know what to do with them. But the heads of the label were old rock guys.
Okay.
You know? And so they got what I was doing, but they were like, "Yeah, we have no resources to do anything with you," and they were nice enough to pay me what they owed me, which was the advance for the second record, which is a significant chunk of change. Which they could have been jerks and not done that,
mm-hmm.
but they did. So I can't. I know a lot of people are bitter about their, you know, here and then gone major label experiences, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in response to that, yeah, I just did what I had been doing all along, which was go back down to Texas and book some gigs. You know, I mean, that was always, like, none of the label stuff really worried me one way or another, because I knew I could always do that. You know, mm-hmm. I could always just do what I was doing all along, which was making a decent living playing gigs and writing songs and just being who I was in Texas, and that was... You know, that turned out to be the case. I mean, people at Mercury lost their jobs. I mean, I basically didn't.
Mm-hmm. So then, eventually, you decided to move on from Texas. And like I said, you're currently living in Minnesota, in
yep.
the Twin Cities area.
Yep.
How did you make that decision?
Well, it did seem like at the end of the Mercury deal, it was the end of a chapter in my life, musically.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because of the deal, but also just, you know, I'd been in Texas almost 10 years, and I felt like I had, you know, accomplished what I set out to do, and I just was looking for just a different point of view, a different look, you know, just a different style of music,
mm-hmm.
and I knew as much about the Twin Cities when I moved there as I did about Texas when I moved there, so, you know, there was no... You know, I wasn't chasing anything in particular, but it was one of my favorite stops when we'd come through on the road in the Mercury days, and I'd gotten a few numbers in my book and called them up and, you know, made a couple of plans, got a place to crash for a while, and I just headed up there. You know, it was nice. I mean, what was nice for me was that's another great music town. There's world-class players all over. And so I was able to, you know, I mean, there's some places you could move to where that's not the case, and I think I would have been really frustrated trying to do music in a town that doesn't really have a mature scene. So that was, you know, that part was easy, and I had done some high-profile gigs. Mm-hmm. The times that I had come through, I'd done festivals and stuff, so people already, kind of the music people in town kind of already knew who I was, which saved a lot of time and, you know, getting doors open and stuff. And, you know, I just... I kind of wanted to re-explore the straight rock thing that I grew up with, you know. Certainly, I mean, Minnesota's not the East Coast, obviously, but it is the North, and there's a certain vibe to the way rock music gets played here that is surprisingly difficult to recreate in Texas.
Gotcha.
You would think, you know, rock and roll is kind of our common cultural language, but it was tricky getting people to, you know, to do a straight up heartland rock thing in a Texas context.
Gotcha. Well, as I presume, in some ways it's not necessarily easy in areas like this to get people who, you know, want to do straight up country either. I mean,
yes, the reverse is definitely true. Yeah.
So. I mean, there's, like, you know, Cleveland's, I'm sure, very similar in that we have a good Americana sort of base going, a good scene, but it's sort of a very underground thing, and if you're not part of it, you don't want to be, kind of, you know?
Right, well, yeah. I think from the time that I've spent here, I think the scene's a little bit bigger in the cities, but not much. Okay. I mean, it's still very niche. And, you know, I do have, you know, a straight country cover side project that I enjoy very much, but there's only a handful of people that I think would be able to do a gig like it. It's not my band, I'm just a singer guitar player in it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's I said I would play with them because they're really good at what they do, and that's not so easy to find. So when they asked me to come do some gigs, I said yeah, because, you know, it's The exact opposite of my Texas experience is true, and it's I love that stuff, you know. It's like I'm not born to it, but man, it's a big part of who I am at this late date, and it's so much fun for me. And I think that, you know, this has stood me in good stead over the years. It's like if I'm invested and I'm having a good time and the band is having a good time, then you can win over a lot of people that don't think they like whatever they think about what the music is, you know. It's like, oh, I don't like country, but you guys were great. I mean,
right.
I get that a lot. And it's like, you know, you need to play with conviction and be good at what you do.
There you go. You can kind of be a force of nature then and drag people into your own sphere, you know.
Indeed.
All right. Well, there was a time, however, that you had some health problems.
Yes.
And you were unable to sing for, what was it, a year and a half? A couple years,
yeah.
Okay. So you ended up with a job at FedEx as a delivery person, right?
Indeed.
And that transitions perfectly into talking about your new album, Faithless World, I believe, is
yes,
the title.
Yes, that's the title.
And it's going to come out in July. Mm-hmm. Where's it going to... I don't know the exact date. You don't either, so it's all good.
No,
but sometime in July, right?
Sometime in July, yeah.
Where is it going to be available when it does come out?
Well, it'll be available at my website, of course, and then
MaryCutrafello.com,
yeah. And all of the normal online places you would expect to find it. And
gotcha.
Then, of course, if we happen to be in the same room, I'll have a copy, most likely.
There you go. So, good excuse to go see you.
There you go.
But the reason that I obviously said that transition from FedEx is because you've put a song on this album that's sort of long been clunking around in your repertoire. But it's just called the FedEx song, right?
It is just called the FedEx song. It is my statement about what it's like to be a FedEx driver in Minnesota in the middle of the winter. It was something that I'd wanted to write for quite a while. I mean, I've been in the FedEx truck for over 9 years now, and God help me.
You've gotten out occasionally, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. There have been long stretches where I mean, I moved back to Texas for a year to promote 35.
I just meant literally out of the truck. Oh. You said you've been in a FedEx truck.
Well.
You know, I'm just saying.
It's just, it feels that way some days. But gotcha. No.
Well, that's what the song's about, basically,
once,
right?
Once I'm done with the boxes, they let me go home and sleep.
Nice.
But no, I mean, I have done it for a while, and I really wanted to write something, because it's good, honest work, but it's hard work, and you know, sometimes it's hard to explain to people sometimes, and it's whatever they think it is, it's probably not quite exactly that, you know, and I really feel like I've made, you know, as definitive a statement about working at FedEx as I'm gonna make. So, and it goes over great, and when I play it live, and it didn't really fit on the last record, which was a kind of slow country thing, but it made perfect sense on this one, which is a little more, it has a different feel to it.
Right. Well, definitely that song in particular, you know, it, to me, it felt like it had sort of a high lonesome country feel, but mm-hmm. then, you know, rock backing. So it sort of was a good example of how you mix the genres in there.
Right on.
But that hasn't always been the case. I mean, you've gone, like you say, from rock albums to country albums. This one seems to vacillate a little bit more back and forth. I mean, it's almost like you have a country song, you have a rock song, you have a country song, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just a couple, you know, Promise Into Darkness,
mm-hmm.
I felt, you know, very Springsteen influenced
yeah,
on that.
Yeah.
I mean, Worthy Girl, which we'll talk about again in a second, mm-hmm. but I mean, that could have been on Nebraska if you know, perfectly fit in.
Right.
Fool for You, another one, very much Heartland Rock influence, it felt to me.
Exactly.
But then on the other side of that, you have, let's see, Lonesome in the Wine.
Yep.
I mean, that was just pure country-themed, basically ode to the bar pickup, right? I mean,
that's exactly what it is.
And then, Three Broken Hearts,
mm-hmm.
which is, again, a classic country love triangle kind of a thing.
That's the love triangle is one of the things that drew me to country music as a songwriter.
Gotcha. Which,
you know, you don't get that in rock so much.
And then another example, Santa Fe Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, like, when you're doing country on this album, you're doing the most country you can find. Like, it's like straight out of George Jones' playbook.
I am not messing around.
You know, train songs. Yeah.
Train songs, cheating songs, you name it.
Exactly. There probably could be a little more drinking song. There's some drinking song, but you know, I'm just saying.
I'll just drink while I play them.
There you go. That's a good plan. But let's real quick just talk about a couple of those in
sure,
particular
and like.
Give people a preview. The one that really stands out to me is Worthy Girl.
Okay.
It's sort of a very dark, kind of twisted sort of take, which I think of sort of what I think of you. You know, you've got that kind of voice where you can, well, no, but you can take something that could be straight ahead, but then you twist it. You know, it's almost like, on the one hand, it's kind of a love song, but on the other hand, it's a self-hate song.
Right. It's like, I love you so much that you have to leave now.
Exactly.
Is kind of what the protagonist is saying. And, you know,
it's almost like a preemptive rejection.
Right. You know? That's exactly what it is. And this was not something that happened to me. Well, for that matter, it's not the story of anyone. It's just one of these kind of made up out of whole cloth songs. But,
okay.
You know, I think it's a feeling that, you know, I guess some people live there, but I think everybody has moments of that, and that's, you know, what I try to shoot for as a writer is things that, you know, that we can all relate to on some level, and that's, you know, unfortunately it's you suffer body blows to your self-worth from time to time, and you know, it's like, of course, you know, what it's really about what you do about that counts, but I don't think that means you shouldn't acknowledge that happens.
Okay. And the one part that I found interesting of that song was you have a little bit of sort of 60s pop harmony backing vocals that pop in just every so often. Was that a purposeful juxtaposition? I'm just wondering how that happens.
You know, there wasn't like a music, you know, I wasn't trying to be a music geek about it.
Mm.
That's G.S. Harper, by the way.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, it was a musical idea I had, and you know, he came out and played bass on the whole record, and he was in there one day, and we were trying some different things, and I said, here, do this, and we kind of just said, okay, and he did it, and I mean, we didn't go, oh, perfect, that's great, but we kind of forgot about it until the end of the recording project, and then it, you know, we were thinking about getting some other singers in, and Greg said, man, he's looking at the tracks, and man, it's, Harper did some stuff on this, you know, let's listen to it, and it turned out we went further with it than we thought. Like, he had done a whole stack of vocals, like three parts. And so we plugged him in, and then we started grinning, because it was, you know, the track had evolved to the point where it made more sense than it did on the day that we did the backing tracks.
I gotcha. Yeah, well, to me, the only thing that's more frightening than one G.S. Harper is three. So
yeah.
I don't know what to do about that, but it's a great song, nevertheless. It's really entertaining. Sort of on the other spectrum, I guess, in some ways, is Fool for You.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a love song without so much of the twist, and it's sort of a poppy song, you know, gets right out there and grabs a hold of you. So can you just tell us a little bit about that and the background of
it? Yeah, I mean, that's actually an older song, and it's fun to play live, but it kind of never found a place on any of the records we were doing, for whatever reason, but it's something that you know, I get people going, well, what you know, that song about Fool Free, what record is that on? And it wasn't on one. So we did a really nice version of it, I think, and you know, we capture the kind of barn burning intensity that we bring to it live, which it doesn't really work if you don't play it like your hair's on fire.
Fair enough. We just had a drive-by fingering by the G.S. Harper.
We got interview bombed.
Funny thing is, I was gonna ask him to come on in and sit in just for the explanation of this next song, but he decided to take off. No, that is actually perfect, because I do want to talk just a little bit about G.S., because like you said, he came out and did all the bass and a lot of the vocals and all that. And he obviously is a Cleveland native, and that's one of the reasons why you...
Well, he's a St. Angelo native, but he's been here for quite a while.
Fair enough. He's a North Coast adoptee, but we'll take him. And he actually is releasing his own album, so he will soon be sitting down for one of these lovely chats.
Excellent.
But specifically, I want to ask you, because you gave him a shout-out...
Mm-hmm.
I believe when he did a guitar solo on Fool for You.
Fools and Lovers.
Or Fools and Lovers,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
My bad.
The other Fool song.
The other Fool song. That's exactly why I screwed it up.
Yeah.
There are two Fool songs. However, Fools and Lovers,
mm-hmm.
G.S. Harper, definitely the former, right? I mean, we just got to get that out of the way.
Oh, he's definitely a fool.
Yeah, yeah.
And we are definitely not lovers.
No. But I just... Knowing him as well as I do, I thought that was a nice little...
Yes, no, it was, you know, we had that section, there's a section of solos, and mm-hmm. we had the banjo player take one, because how often do you have a banjo player in the studio, right? And G.S., you know, he's a great bass player, but I think probably most folks listening to this know him as a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
We just had him pick, here, just take a pass at one of these turns, and... You know, kind of the same thing as the vocals. We'll file it away, and when we get around to finishing the song, we'll see what comes in. And you know, and he just, as he does, you know, he played his ass off, and so we had to use that. And then, you know, I wanted to make sure that people knew that it was him, because what's probably going to go around is that he played bass on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wouldn't necessarily think that somebody taking the guitar lead was G.S. So, you know, I did that kind of old-timey kind of Ernest Tubb you know, ah, Billy Bird now, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, that's what I liked about it, because you see that live a lot, but it doesn't come up in an album.
It rarely comes up in a studio recording,
The other really unique thing about that song was there's sort of a folk a cappella kind of introduction to that one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How did you land on that idea?
That one, I hadn't played that one a lot, but I'd done it a little bit, and we had... There were times when I had a band with three singers, and we worked out the three-part intro. And for this recording, we got my friends Michael Perry and the Longbeds. Michael Perry is a New York Times best-selling author, and then he's got a band too. He's just a talented cat, and they have a great four-part blend. And you know, I love what they do, and they hire me every now and then to be their featured guest guitarist. And I said, man, let's just get that blend on the front and just make it, you know, just a little special, like 20 seconds, you know. And that's, so they came in from, they're over in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and they came in for an afternoon, laid that down. We had a really good, and I'm just happy to have them on the record, because, you know, then I get to talk about them in interviews.
There you go. We are 5 minutes away from showtime, so we better let you go, but thank you so much for joining us. Once again, this Mary Cutrafello, the new album is Faithless Worlds. It'll be out in July at some point.
At some point.
Probably by the time you hear this, it'll be out. And it'll be available somewhere and everywhere. Mary will also be somewhere and everywhere, so check her site, marycutrafello.com. Find out where she's touring, because it really is worth it getting to see her, and I'm glad I'm about to do it once again.
Awesome. Thanks, Jason.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and this has been another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats.
This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt-country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.